Good evening, Kansas City. You're listening to Radioactive Magazine on 90.1 KKFI FM, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm your host, Brian Nolan. Join with me is my good friend, Dr. Nathan Madden. Nate is a research analyst for a statewide organization, and in the past, he's worked for Bridging the Gap and conducting research, graduated from Minnesota State University Mankato campus with a bachelor's degree, and has earned a PhD in political science from the University of Missouri. Nate, how are you this evening?
I'm doing well. How about yourself, Brian?
I'm great. Tonight we're talking about the presidential circus, focusing on the crazy nature of our presidential primaries. Let's get in right to it. Donald Trump, my number one favorite Democrat in all of the race, not least of all because of how well he does berating and bullying Republicans, the best Democrat I've ever seen. What's going on with Donald Trump?
You know, I think Donald Trump is a reflection of the politics of unraveling in the country right now. He is someone who has been able to peddle his wares on both sides of the political aisle. And I think that one thing that we all need to realize about Donald Trump, and this was prompted especially yesterday, there was a slate of new articles in the various political publications talking about how the GOP establishment is going to do a big takedown of Donald Trump. He is the political equivalent of the blob. The more you feed him, the more you put in his way to try and destroy him, the stronger he gets. I think they're doing themselves a disservice by taking that step forward.
Chris Christie, I think very aptly, came out, endorsed Donald Trump, saying that he's the future of the Republican Party, that the Republican Party's kicking themselves for not recognizing it. Do you agree with Christie?
Yeah, he does represent the future of the Republican Party, an older, whiter, elitist sort of organization that caters to the views of a narrowing perspective of the American electorate. And by the way, I have to compliment Christie on one of the most cynical moves I have ever seen done politically. I almost couldn't believe the words he was saying, and you could see during the conference where he was announcing his support for Trump that it was really tough for him to say that, especially all the documented instances where he said Trump is not suitable to lead the country.
So you applaud Christie because of his what? Because he's
just
so cynical?
Just unbridled, uncut, raw cynicism regarding what it might take. He's looking into the effect Trump's having on the Republican primaries, and he sees, if Donald Trump were to be elected, an opportunity. I don't know what that is, whether it'd be splitting the ticket with Donald Trump or maybe Attorney General, but there's something behind that. This wasn't done purely out of the good nature of Chris Christie's heart.
Just for fun, March 1st, the day this show airs, Super Tuesday, who's going to win? What's your prediction?
Well, because it's, I believe, a dozen states, you know, it's going to be hard to find a clear-cut winner, but I was looking at some of the polls on the real good aggregating sites, especially, 538 and Real Clear Politics and Pollster, that's out of the Huffington Post. And Donald Trump has a pretty significant lead in 8 of those 12 states. So
he's the best. I'm Donald.
Donald, I'm huge. he's probably going to come out with the most delegates. And look, we have to realize that on the Republican side of things, if Donald Trump has to do is come out fairly strong on Super Tuesday, and his path to the nomination is virtually locked up.
It's a slam dunk. So 538, Nate Silver, one of the most heralded pollsters, predicted so much about Obama's race 2008, 2012, has not been able to do this one very accurately. Iowa, he got totally wrong. Some of the other predictions, he's just gotten totally wrong. What's going on? Why can't we do a better job at predicting some of this? Is it just this new Donald factor is throwing everything off? Or are we seeing some changes in the electorate, new trends that are making it impossible to accurately predict this stuff through our usual polling routines?
I think it's a whole host of things, actually. Number one, I would always take prognostications about primaries and caucuses with a grain of salt, because remember, we're dealing with, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, a very ideologically small and narrow part of the electorate. So it becomes much more difficult to make a prediction about that that's accurate. So be looking for those in the general election, though. I think you're going to see a much closer, much narrowing down in terms of being able to kind of get close. Because you'll even see in the 2012 election that Nate Silver and a lot of the other pollsters were not that far off in predicting a fairly sizable win.
They're getting their information from people. They're reaching out to them typically by their phone.
Right.
Do cell phones have a profound limiting impact on the information they're going to get?
Well, yes. I have an Iowa phone number, area code, and I was expecting to get quite a few survey requests during the caucus period or leading up to it, and I really didn't. I got a couple, but not that many. So I don't think pollsters are digging into the cell phone side of the electorate. And, you know, if you don't call cell phones, you're not going to get a person like me because I don't have a landline.
No one has a landline anymore.
You're right. But one thing that you want to look for in polls, I think, is how much are they varying their methodology? And I've seen some of the better polls that are out there. They're using they're getting more people.
You can nerd out.
Okay. So they're using a higher sample size. Let's face it. If you see a sample size below 500, I would discredit that poll to a large degree. And number two, look for mixed methodology. So are they using traditional landlines? Are they finding some cell phones? And also even computer internet style sampling. You know, you can get a 10%. Now, people argue that you can't do that in a random fashion. That's true because of the digital divide, so it skews your sample a little more white, but you can make weightings that can correct for these. So
just so we're defining our terms, digital divide meaning the division between white, black, rich, poor, white, color, and the use of technology and cell phones. Now, if you're not self-reporting on your voter registration form your cell phone number, it's going to be almost impossible for these pollsters to get this number. So are we finally reaching the tipping point by which a majority of the electorate are not voluntarily giving out their cell phone numbers so pollsters can't predict accurately anymore who you're going to vote for because they're not calling you?
Right. I think that that's definitely part of it. And not to mention the fact that a lot of people are a lot more skeptical about where they're laying down their cell phone number and email address. You know, a lot of people are getting unsolicited calls from God knows whoever, not to mention all the email we get. So people are not as prone to lay out that information. So I think we are at a turning point where pollsters really got to get creative. They need to update their phone lists, and they need to make sure that they have access to a broad array of the voting populace.
Donald Trump, the Trump effect, doesn't seem to transcend with Hillary as much. Bernie has a lot of younger voters. Younger voters like Donald Trump's new voters, people who really never participated in the political process before, are they also making it difficult to determine the outcomes of these results?
You know, I actually want to challenge the notion that a lot of Trump supporters are people who are not involved in the political process or haven't been involved in the political process. We saw in Iowa that they weren't involved in the political process at all, because if you're going to be a caucus voter, you're going to be very heavily involved in the process. And they didn't show up in as strong a numbers as they should have to help win him the state. So with primaries, it's a little more watered down, but I think with the Trump effect, it's he's bringing out a lot more people, it seems like, but what he's doing is he's managing to grab these really angry chunks from all the varying Republican electorates, the libertarians, the evangelicals, the very hardline conservatives of Ted Cruz's ideological pedigree. So I don't know. He has this talent for doing this. It's when you watch him in the debates, you can get a gut feeling as to why he's drawing these people out.
Any campaign I've worked on, we always try to shy away from or steer ourselves away from the use of spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on television ads. In a small race, it's just impossible. With Trump, though, he doesn't need to spend any money on anything, it seems like, because he's constantly subsumed in this 24-hour news cycle. Is that giving him a profound boost that also makes it difficult to predict the outcomes of these elections, because they're not using traditional field campaigning or the tactics that many campaigns have focused on in the past?
Right. I mean, field campaign will win you the diehards of your party, which is why Ted Cruz won Iowa. I saw that coming a mile off, because Ted Cruz made a promise to visit all 99 counties. He made a promise to go to as small of gathering as possible. So there is nothing that when you have the time to make a strong field campaign, it will pay off for you. Now, when we're getting into these Super Tuesday states and we start having multiple primaries every week, it's going to get a lot more difficult to do that. But Donald Trump, let's face it, his ratio of money spent per vote gotten is lower than most of the other candidates. And that's largely because of the 24-hour news cycle churn, and he is the leading factor in all that. He's always the big lead on the news channels, the news networks, the online resources.
We're going to tax millionaires and billionaires. Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, they seem like the opposite side of the same coin of anger. Particularly, you want to talk tonight about the implications of the rise of anti-establishment politics. Again, the common thread seems to be anger. The American electorate, furious. Can you talk a little bit about what you see to be the implications of the rise of this anti-establishment politics?
Sure. I use the term the politics of unraveling at the beginning of this. And what's happening in the American electorate, from my point of view, is that we have an electoral system that is much too simplistic for the various and deep divides that we have in our society. When you have an electoral system that's going to produce one alternative or the other alternative, Democrats or Republicans, you can't adequately represent the entire array of issues that weigh on the minds of the American electorate. So of course they get angry. Of course you're going to have the far right get extremely upset by what they see as kowtowing to the Obama administration. We've even seen that on the far left. We've seen a lot of criticism of things that Obama has done that they perceive not to be as progressive enough. So basically, from an institutional sense, we have too few parties representing the broad amount of interests and varying coalitions that exist within each party.
So is the solution then having multi-parties, third parties, or is the solution a parliamentary democracy?
Well, see, that's where we start getting into the pickle, because institutional reform in the U.S. would be, I mean, it would probably involve a constitutional convention, and I just watched a constitutional convention call in Kansas go down in flames because people were scared that, you know, the conservative voice of Kansas wouldn't be adequately represented enough. So that, I don't think, is going to happen. I think a good external model for this would be to look at Canada. They have something that I would call a fractious left. They have several parties that are associated with center or leftist politics, and they have a fairly cohesive right wing. I think in the United States, if we ended up with a model like that, we'd probably have a fractious left and right with several parties representing each wing and each set of agenda items, and then we'd probably have a more centrist party. But I don't think that it's just going to magically happen. It's going to be a painful process, and we're probably going to witness a big political transformation here in the next 10 years. Not a revolution, as Bernie would say, but something's going to change. Something's got to give.
Even in the debates, I've watched every Republican debate, they're never asking the candidates, how are you going to appeal to the moderate middle? Because the one time they asked a similar question, their result was uniformly, well, the majority of voters clearly support our positions on everything, which couldn't be farther from the truth. What's happening to the moderate middle, the majority of the country who, in some respect, have more moderate positions? It's not so liberal. It's not so Republican. What's the deal?
Well, they're still there. I think what the most important thing to remember about the moderates is they usually don't get a say until by the time the general election rolls around. Missouri has an open primary along with 18 other states. The rest of them are closed, so you have to be a pretty partisan person to go vote in Nevada, the Nevada caucuses, or the Iowa caucuses, or the South Carolina primary. You know, you have to be a pretty diehard believer in whichever party is offering up what. So basically, we won't know where they're at until the general election, and I really don't think that someone like Donald Trump is going to appeal to those moderates as much, because when they hear comments about illegal or undocumented workers being, see, Donald Trump's in my head even. when he talks about undocumented workers or undocumented people in the United States being rapists or murderers or drug peddlers, that's not appealing to the a wide amount of the electorate. So I just have a hard time believing that their voice has truly been heard yet.
So we'll presume that we know everything about everything and that we can go and predict what's going to happen in the general election. Although it seems clear, Donald Trump is going to win the primary. That's my prediction.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the general. What do you think we need to look for, watch for in the general?
I think one of the top things to be aware of is who is the GOP picking for their VP candidate? Is it going to be one of these people that is an also ran in the nominating process here, or are we going to end up with someone else? I honestly think that Marco Rubio would be a great VP pick. He actually strikes me as someone who would be a formidable opponent for Hillary in the general election, but just because of the way the delegate math is starting to work out, I really don't think he has a chance of making it. And the longer that, you know, John Kasich and Ben Carson and Ted Cruz stay in the race, the more, the less of a chance that he has of coming even close. So I think one of the things we need to be aware of is what sort of pick is the Donald going to make for his running mate?
How do we stack up Hillary compared to Donald Trump right now? What are the results looking like?
You know, there's not actually a ton of new polling data on that matchup in particular. There's some early polls that show him getting absolutely crushed by her, but her being Hillary and the polarizing figure that she is, I could see her still winning a general election in a head-to-head matchup with Donald Trump. But honestly, here's the thing about the person running the Democratic presidential campaign in the general. How do you handle Donald Trump? Because as I said before, he gets stronger the more you try to attack him, because it just feeds into his own built narrative that I am someone from the outside who comes and takes this. So I don't know. Maybe you just ignore him during the debate. You like literally pretend he is not there. Minimize him.
But how do you have someone like Rubio or Cruz on the ticket when they've spent so much of their time and political capital and money on utterly defaming Donald Trump? How do you do it? The Democrats just run an ad saying, yeah, even their own party hates the guy. You know, his vice president hates him. Look at what they said. How do you do that?
Right. Well, not to mention Donald Trump has things that would look way worse on a political ad and in campaign messaging than what Hillary Clinton does. You know, hers are almost a little obscure. You have to be a politico to kind of really understand that, oh, she used a private email server to conduct state business. Donald Trump has done things that literally cut immediately against his own positions and using non-American undocumented workers to build his various construction projects. So I feel like there's a much greater risk of exposure to those types of messaging in the general election.
So what sort of special or unique mechanisms are at play for the general that we need to be honed in on as voters who want to be well informed?
Well, I would say that you should probably make sure that you're keeping up to date on what the daily tracking figures are, just to kind of give you an idea of the ebb and flow on a daily basis. So as soon as the nominating contests are over and the party conventions are done this summer, we're going to have a head-to-head matchup before that real hardcore campaigning gets underway. So just keep your eye on that. And one thing I would also keep an eye out for is how soon is a president or a vice presidential pick made by the Republicans, because if this is left up to Donald Trump and him alone, we have no idea who he could pick for a VP. But if
it'll be Ben Carson.
It'll be Carly Fiorina? No.
No, not going to happen.
What about Jim Gilmore?
I think Democratic side of it, what do we need to watch for vice presidential pick for Hillary, who I think is absolutely going to be the nominee?
Yeah.
Not going to be Bernie. My money's been on I just forgot a name. Cory Booker.
Cory Booker,
U.S. Senator from New Jersey. What are your thoughts?
I had a really good discussion with someone who made the strong case for a Elizabeth Warren VP pick, and I always thought of her as someone who would stay out of it until she could make her own run for president. but there's just too much upside with including her on the ticket. And the person equated it to a Clinton Gore type of pick. It's not really a state strategic pick. Like, we're not picking a person from a battleground state to help increase our odds. We're making a pick that's broadly popular to our electorate and getting them out to the polls. That I honestly was partially convinced, although I do see Cory Booker as a strong pick. I don't think it'll be Julian Castro, because that seems like an outwardly and unabashedly pick just to get Latino voters. It doesn't seem as sincere of a pick from a strategic standpoint.
I'd love to see Michael Bloomberg. I think one of the most important issues in the election is, how do you, as the president, bring the country back to the middle? How do you bring the country back together? And I think Bloomberg would help provide that focus. But if I was a multi-billionaire, I probably wouldn't waste my time being vice president.
Well, and also, how successful do you think Bloomberg's going to be in the general? I don't think he would pull that many voters. A lot of people have put him up as the boogeyman of spoiling the chances for Democrats winning the election this year. But he embodies the establishment. He gets hated on the left for a wide number of things, and he gets pilloried on the right because of things like restricting limits on how big a soda can be in New York City. So I just don't see I don't see him being the centrist godsend, so to speak.
So let's get briefly into some of the mechanics of the conventions, delegates, superdelegates, and going back to the primary. Kansas decided to have a caucus. I've met some people from Kansas. I have some serious doubts as to whether or not they'd be able to understand what a caucus is. Are they going to be able to do it? What is a caucus? How's it going to go in Kansas?
So a caucus around the United States, especially on the Democratic side, has relatively transferable rules where you can understand one state by what happened in the other state. But look, as I said before, this is made for the party elite, the party diehards. Those are the people who are going to, because of their beliefs, want to really dive into what it takes to be in a caucus. And the Kansas caucus is very similar to the Iowa caucus in that there is no secret ballot. You form into preference groups on the first round of voting. And if your candidate doesn't get 15%, which there won't be a problem of that happening in Kansas since there's only two candidates, then they are counted as unviable. And those people who chose that candidate are up for grabs from the remaining viable candidates. And if you are an undecided, there's also a table for the undecided folks. You can be wooed by the people who are decided. It's not arm twisting, so to speak. It's more of trying to put together the best winning sales pitch. And that's where if you're a Clinton or a Sanders person, having a person who can make a good pitch really makes a lot of the difference in caucuses.
Those people don't even understand the importance of having public schools. So again, I doubt that they're going to be able to understand that, but I wish them well. The Kansas caucus is March 5th. 40 GOP delegates will be awarded, 37 delegates on the Democratic side. Missouri's primary is March 15th. 52 delegates on the GOP side, 84 delegates on the Democratic side are up for grabs. Superdelegates and brokered conventions. Can you tell us a little bit about what a superdelegate is?
Well, they're more explicitly known on the Democratic side because they've been around in the Democratic lexicon since the 2008 race with Hillary and Barack. And that's when we really did first learn about them. These are the people who are party elites. They're elected officials. They're state party chairs. They're a wide variety of the upper echelon in the Democratic Party. So they get basically the same voting delegate power and are free to choose as someone who works their way up through the caucus, the county convention, the regional convention, and on through the state convention to get to the national convention to cast their vote. So that's why they're called superdelegates. They're a little bit super.
GOP doesn't even call them superdelegates. They have three per state, made up of the state party's chairperson and a committee man, committee woman. And they're required by the party rules to vote with the majority of the state. Democratic side, it's a little more complicated. 15% of all the delegates are superdelegates, but that's a pretty small number of the 4,763 delegates total to be awarded. I know people are continuing to talk about brokered conventions or contested conventions, so let's get a little bit into that. What's a brokered convention?
A brokered convention would basically be when you don't have a conclusive or decisive victor in all these nominating contests that we're going through. And effectively what happens...
Sorry to interrupt, but the key there is if it's contested, meaning if we're looking at a 50.1% of the party supports or doesn't support, when we have a brokered
convention. Yeah, you can still have a brokered or contested election. Even if you have 50% plus one of the delegates... People can still be rightly challenge who that majoritarian winner is. So basically what you end up with is a bunch of negotiations happening on the floor. And what it'll end up being is that you'll have the delegate or the candidate who's being contested, and then you'll have everyone else, and they may form a coalition of sorts to try and get someone else on the ticket. And they'll engage literally on the floor and in the hallways of wherever the convention's being held, of trying to figure out what sort of deal can be made to get your delegate over to the person who's being contested, or vice versa, getting the contested candidate's delegates over to a different person. It's basically pure, raw, uncut politics.
The long and short, how likely will it be that we have a brokered or contested convention on either side of the aisle?
Democrats, zero chance. Hillary Clinton will be the nominee, especially after South Carolina. I was a little questioning what might happen depending on the Nevada outcome, but that was roughly in line with what I expected. But with the Republicans, it depends on how big of a threat the establishment determines Donald Trump to be, whether they say we cannot move forward with him as our nominee, or they finally just say, well, I guess we have to accept him as our nominee.
But if he gets a majority of the delegates, they can't do anything about it.
Like we said before, if it's a very slim majority, yeah, then there's some wiggle room. But if he's turning up with 60% of the delegates, then a contested convention would not go well. It would be seen as a nuclear meltdown.
My understanding is that by the rules, it's impossible. If he gets a vast majority or a lion's share of the votes, it's a done deal.
I don't know the specific rules on what you can do to go to do a contested convention on the GOP side. But yeah, if he's coming away with a clear mandate from all the delegates, then I don't see it happening. So a lot of this remains to be seen on Tuesday.
As a quick, interesting historic note, 1952 on the Democratic side, Adlai Stevenson was the product of a brokered convention. 1948 on the GOP side, Thomas E. Dewey, product of a brokered convention. 1976 here in Kansas City, Missouri at the GOP convention, it was a contested convention. Reagan tried to steal the nomination from Gerald Ford, that snaky devil. And of an interesting note, the last successful winner of a brokered convention was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 1932.
And can you imagine how that might look, especially in the 24 hours news cycle now? It would be covered wall to wall, and it would be seen as a partisan meltdown.
Joined with me tonight was guest Dr. Nathan Madden, research analyst, all around good guy. We thank you for listening to Radioactive Magazine on 90.1 KKFI FM, Kansas City Community Radio.